It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
Welcome to Money for Lunch. Man, I am excited to have you here. Why? Because it's Thanksgiving week. It's a great time to be thankful. And, you know, earlier during the week, I was talking about the attitude of gratitude and what a miracle it is to have that attitude in your life, right? The research shows that individuals with an attitude of gratitude live happier, longer lives, right? Bottom line is gratitude pays you big dividends. You're healthier. You have more fun. People like to be around you. Negativity does not pay. Being a sour pickle does not pay. Okay. It's going to cost you more than just profits. It's going to cost you relationships. It's going to cost you health. It's going to cost you wealth. It's going to cost you spirituality. Look, we all have crap to deal with. Life is not easy. But guess what? It wasn't meant to be. I mean, what fun would it be if we got everything we wanted instantly? We'd be a bunch of spoiled kids and we wouldn't have the gratitude necessary to really be thankful for what we have. And that's what, you know, it's one of the ways that it's set up that way, right? God, in his wisdom, decided to, hey, you know what? If we work for something, we tend to value it more. Bless you, Adam.
Thank you.
We have a live audience today. Adam's in the house, and he just sneezed. I know people. Yeah. In case you were wondering what that thunderous noise was, it's just him sneezing. Anyway, but speaking of money, speaking of finances, speaking about gratitude, I'm grateful for my first guest, Angela Sloan. Angela Sloan is the CEO and founder of Sloan Financial Group, has dedicated herself to helping her clients secure their financial affairs. Unfortunately, at a young age, she was swindled out of her life savings by her trusted advisor. This misfortune motivated Angela to make it her life's work to keep bad things from happening to good people. She specializes in income tax planning, managed money, conservative investments. She has expanded her practice to include estate planning, long-term care insurance, Medicare supplements, life insurance, and property and casualty insurance. Angela Sloan, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here. Wonderful. Right here at Thanksgiving, my favorite time of the year is actually Thanksgiving because we do have so much to be thankful for. And I just want to thank you for having me on, and hopefully we can spread a little bit of news that'll help somebody today.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, this is such a kind of a neat story in the sense that, you know, again, early on in your career, you had this misfortune, or early on in your life, you had this misfortune. And I want to talk about this a little bit because prior to you having this financial misfortune, were you in the financial industry? Were you selling insurance products? Talk a little bit about what you were doing before. Okay.
Never in my wildest imagination did I think I'd be doing what I'm doing. And had that not happened to me, and the exact amount I lost was $14,440, and I call that my $14,440 PhD. Because right. Had that not happened to me, I would not be where I am today. And never in my wildest imagination did I think that I would have a business that looks the way it looks today. I mean, I was a mom. I was a church secretary. I wasn't in the money business. I had just always been taught to save, and saving faithfully $155 a month. So for me to lose $14,000, that was all the money in the world. Plus, I found out I was sick, and I needed money to pay medical bills, which is why it came to my attention that I had lost this money. When I went to my account, I found out I just had a little over $800, and couldn't figure out why, what happened. I even went so far as to get a hearing before the state commissioner, and I was told, quote, what happened to you is unethical, but it's not illegal. Now,
what?
I grew up on, it's unethical, but it's not illegal. Now, I don't think that would fly today, but 30-some years ago it did. And, you know, I growing up on the longest dirt road in the state of South Carolina, I thought, okay, how could something be unethical and not illegal? Because where I come from, you got your tail tore up for either one of those things. There was no difference. And honestly, if I could find a man that did that today, I would kiss him right on the lips because he has no idea what he did for me.
Well, you know what, and this is one of those great examples where it sounds like this horrible situation wasn't done to you, it was done for you. Where the you know, where God's hand intervened and knew that her child would react the way you did, and because you did react that way, I mean, you could have just. You know, you could have done nothing, but because you reacted, responded the way you did, you changed not only your life, but the lives of your clients.
Well, you know, he knows what it takes to elbow us into where we need to be. And I've often said, I think sometimes I'm the entertainment in heaven. I can see God elbowing the angels going, hey, watch what this one does.
Absolutely. But you know what? That's just the right attitude because, you know, as I opened the show about having the attitude of gratitude, you know, we have to have this thing and not to freak people out and start, you know, quoting scripture here, but in the Bible, and not just in the Bible, but in the Old Testament and some other scriptures out there from different religious sects, God mentions being grateful in all things, not just in the good, but being grateful for all things. And I think the reason he wants us to be grateful in all things, because, again, this is quoting scripture, you know, that God works, you know, that all the stuff works for our good. That eventually the fact that you got swindled out of $14,440 was the best thing that happened to you. And here you are ready to kiss that man on the lips because he changed your life for the best.
He did, Bert. But now I'm going to be honest with you. When all of this was first coming out, when it was all first being exposed, looking for good in everything. And I was to give him a kiss. Okay, I was looking to have his neck in a noose. So I'll be the first to tell you, you're going to have that immediate human reaction of let me get my hands on him. And, you know, how could this happen to me? So, you know, I did not come to this conclusion overnight. This took time, and it was this female seeking revenge as to why I learned what I learned, because I just became a sponge. I started reading. I started researching. I want to know why this happened. I took out all my papers and a Webster's Dictionary, rewrote everything on a legal pad in plain English, sat back and said, why would anybody do this? And, of course, the answer is because people just don't know better. And so it was a process. Now, I didn't come out. I was not initially quoting scripture. Okay, that came with some time, but there again, you know, God still knew what it was going to take to light my fire.
Sure. Now, and it sounds like this gentleman didn't necessarily, I mean, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, did he, quote, swindle you, or did he just mismanage your money because he was trying to make a bunch of commission? Yeah.
He was trying for commission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was trying
for commission. That happens, and that still happens today. You know, bottom line is the standard for some of these people to manage your money or how they manage their money, the standard is so low. So, you know, what do you call it? So, has so much wiggle room. Yeah, self-serving. I mean, you know, they can put you in a product that will not help you. They'll still earn commission as long as it's, quote, suitable, and that's such a low standard. So, you know what? Let's talk about this a little bit. You know, here we are. We're in, fast approaching on 2017. Women have done a lot. They've come up quite a bit in the career, if you will, they're earning more money, but women still earn less. Let's talk about this. How do you help, you know, Sloan Financial Group and women earning less, you know, what do you do with I guess some of your clients who aren't maybe earning what they should?
Well, first of all, it's educating them and living within their means, of course. And
yes.
They need to be educated on the fact that, yeah, you may earn less than men. You're not going to change that yourself overnight. But you can still have a good life. You just have to plan. You're going to need to make those dollars last longer because you're going to live longer. There's a greater chance of longevity for the women. And, of course, they're more likely than men to take a career break in order to raise their children or take care of aging parents. And that really does hinder their retirement. And it hinders them more so because of the age when they take that that time off for family. So it's very important that they have all of this planned out. If they have it planned out and are prepared, they can get to a good retirement, but they can't just fly by the seat of their pants and say, oh, well, you know, tomorrow's another day, it'll be okay. You can't stick your head in the sand, and women tend to do that. They don't like to talk about these issues. But fortunately, these things are taken, they're getting attention from the lawmakers and the economists. You know, they're starting to take note, because when women get older, they're more likely than men to live in poverty. And that's due to a lot of reasons. You know, they have a lot of disadvantages, and the pay gap is one of them. And, of course, taking that time off at a very critical point in their lives to raise children or take care of aging parents is another thing that's a great hindrance to them. So the variables are also different for women. So, for example, you know, for men, you've got variables. You know, he could get sick. He might not have enough life insurance. For women, the variables are entirely different. You know, as I said before, they're going to be the likely one to take time off if they have an elderly parent that needs to be taken care of. And sometimes it might be the husband's parent, but she's going to be the one more likely to take the time off. And she will be more likely the one to take the time off to raise children. You know, sometimes in today's world, you see some men do that, but not very often. It still remains a role that's taken on by women. So the career break is one of the most serious setbacks that a woman can take, because she's taken that break from her career. But usually, if she's college educated, the average, she's taken that break between age 45 and 55 years old. And that's a critical time, and that is causing her to have, on average, one study found about $1.1 million shortfall.
Wow.
You know, that 10-year period from 45 to 55 is a critical time period for her to be taking that break financially.
Sure.
So it's even more harmful when they take that break between age 35 and 45, because that's when again, they're college-educated women, or they're starting families at about age 35, and that's when they're at their highest earnings potential, and they're also missing out on a lot of compounding during those early years. So taking a break at that age, it leads to a shortfall of about $1.3 million in that same study. So if they're taking the break between 45 and 55, the study says they're taking about a $1.1 million shortfall. And if they take that break between 35 and 45, it's even more. It's $1.3 million shortfall. So that hit is larger for younger women, because they end up missing out on the compound interest and whatnot. So putting
sure.
away more
well,
money
you know what?
Early is the way to close that gap.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And I think also one of the things that women have a tough time managing, and that is putting themselves first. Especially
oh, yeah.
women, you know, especially women, you know, especially women that are mothers. You know, you get into that mother mode where, a lot of mothers will put themselves second, third, or fourth, or fifth down the road. And I saw this with my wife. You know, she wasn't taking time to work out. She wasn't taking time to, to grab a break from the kids to do something. And when she did take time away from the kids, she felt guilty as though she wasn't being a good mom. And it took a lot of training to get her to just say, you know what, I'm still a good mother, even though I'm going to take an hour or two for myself. And I think that is one of the things that I'm so happy to see in the moms today, that they realize it's okay for me to take a break from the kids that I love so much, or the family that I'm so devoted to. It's absolutely okay. But I think that is something that nurture instinct needs to be rewired a little bit, because a lot of women feel guilty if, they're not spending every penny on their kids. I see this all the time. Mothers who are working two jobs and they tell their kids, no, you can't have that. And let me tell you, no is sometimes the most important thing you can do for your family that you love so much, because nothing will give you more peace of mind and put you in a position of power than having a bunch of money in the bank, than having your retirement set, than knowing that you have financial, that you have some financial choices.
And here's my answer to these women who are in that predicament, and I see it every day. And here's what I tell them every single time. The best thing you can do for your children is to be able to take care of yourself in retirement. Mm. I am in a position where my mother lives with me. She is solely dependent on me. If I couldn't do what I do and pay a nurse to be there every day, I don't know where she'd be.
Right.
She'd be in some Medicaid home somewhere. So is it a burden on me? Oh, yes, it is. But it's my mother. I'm going to do what I have to do. I told my kids over and over, I will not do this to my children. I won't do it. The best thing you can do for your children is to be able to take care of yourself in retirement. Which one of them do you want to change your diaper?
It's so funny you should say that, Angela, because I threaten my kids all the time with that. My plan is to live to 104, and I have five kids, and I've told them all that I want to spend a year with all of them. I want to give them the opportunity to change my diaper just like I changed theirs. I think it's a wonderful experience. And I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, so those diapers are going to be.
In reality, it would be very humiliating. And
it would be. Absolutely. All kidding aside.
I can't say it loud enough. I will not do that to my kids. Number one. Number two, I don't want to lose my dignity. And of course, with a parent, I'll do what I have to do. But I would rather my kids be a care coordinator than a caregiver.
Yes.
And the difference is the ones who are the care coordinator are coordinating the care because mom had enough brains about her to set forth a plan to where she has the long-term care taken care of. So, I would much rather them be the care coordinator than the caregiver.
Absolutely. Angela, we're out of time. I can't wait to have you back on the show and talk more about this. Angela, this is such an important thing. Absolutely. Get together with Pam and have Pam contact Amy. We'll get you back on the show to talk more about this. Such an important thing. And you know what? Here's the thing that I think this is one of the myths that a lot of people fall under is that I don't have enough money to save, or I don't have enough money for retirement. And I'd love to bring you back and talk about the myth of saving and investing money, because there's a lot of people doing it every day with virtually no money. And there's tons of stories out there of people who were able to retire well because they planned ahead, even though they're making 30, 40, 50 grand a year. So let's do that next time you come on the show, Angela.
Absolutely. Be glad to. Thank you so much for having me. And everybody out there, have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I love it. Good stuff there from Angela Sloan. The name of the company is Sloan Financial Group, and I'm thinking the website's got to be very close to that. So find out more about Angela at Sloan Financial Group. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite.
Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, Milo Shapiro. Milo Shapiro left his job. There we go. Sorry about that. Teleprompter issue. So he left his job in IT in 2000 to create a company called Improv Ventures, creating team building events using improvisational games. In 2004, Improv Ventures expanded their offerings with a new branch called Public Dynamics, offering coaching and training in public speaking skills. He has since helped hundreds of people become, as his book cover says, prepared, polished, and powerful. Milo Shapiro, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. So let's do this because, you know, here you are. You're in the IT career track, and you're sitting around going, you know what? I don't want to do IT anymore. I want to go do this improv stuff. So talk about how you went from IT guy to improv ventures guy.
Sure. I had been doing improv with people after hours and on my weekends, even traveling up to other cities in Canada and the U.S. To study improv, but I was keeping my day job because who quits their day job in IT making nearly six figures to go do something as crazy as pursuing improv, where you'd be lucky if you make four figures, initially at least. So it was not something I was really going to do, but I was offered a voluntary separation package around the same time that someone pointed out to me a company on the East Coast was using improv for team building. And I thought, wow, you know, there's actually a way to monetize this then if I could get into organizations and show them how the people I was doing improv with on a regular basis were always saying how this was helping them in their careers. Because improv teaches us about listening skills, building on each other's ideas, creative problem solving, and anyone I knew who was doing improv was seeing the benefits in their jobs. So I made a list of the games I might do and finally got the guts up and accepted that voluntary separation package and started Improv Ventures so that I'd be able to go in and have fun with my days and give other people fun in the process. But a lot of team building is fun and not much more. There's so much to be learned from these improv games, and I've seen it make a difference in companies who brought people in to do this kind of work. So that's how I made the switch over and left IT behind, and I haven't missed it one bit, I got to tell you.
Well, okay, so walk me through your thinking here. I've taken some improv classes. Mm-hmm. I love improv. I saw, for instance, how improv kind of helped me come out a little bit out of my shell. So when you're saying, hey, improv is a great way to team build, give me some examples of what you mean.
Sure. If a boss were to go up to an employee and say, you know, I notice when you're talking, I'll make up two names, Diane and Steve. If Diane, go up to Diane and say, you know, I notice when you're talking to Steve that when he comes up with ideas, you cut him off all the time and don't let build on his ideas. Diane's probably going to be on the defensive. But if I'm doing a game with them where they're not succeeding and not reaching the goal they want to because Diane is doing that, I can stop and say, Diane, I think part of the reason you guys haven't hit the end of this game yet is when Steve said that, you built on the last thing you just said. So listen to what Steve just said, and I want to see you creatively build on that. And then when she does, I can say, yes, how did that feel? Yeah, that felt good. Okay, good. And then they finish the game, and they high-five each other. They're doing great. Well, I've just helped her to see in a way that she does this without it getting personal, because we take our work lives and our work evaluations so personally, especially if they're coming from the boss. I'm an outsider. I'm only there for the day. I'm trying to help her succeed at the game. But Steve feels good because he feels heard. The boss over in the corner gives me the thumbs up, like, yes, she always does that. Thank you for catching that. So that's just one example of how I can help people recognize things. And there's other games where we start to notice patterns that people have. We start recognizing each other's personal patterns. I talk about that. And not every game looks like Whose Line Is It Anyway. Some of the games are a little bit more – there's a game that involves a ball toss. And the way this works, every once in a while, a ball is going to a place where someone is chasing the ball already. So people are throwing to an empty hole, and that ends up creating some laughter. But then I get to talk about the analogy of how are we at work sometimes throwing to the empty hole. It might be someone, you know, sending an email to someone who's on vacation and expecting an answer. That's throwing to an empty hole. I had a boss where if I spoke to her before her second cup of coffee, right, that was throwing to an empty hole. So we get to make these analogies as well.
Yeah, I like that. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that was an empty hall too. Okay, so let's talk about this. You know, this gamification, I think, is obviously that, you know, gamification in general is being used more and more in business. And I think that one of the reasons for that, and I want to get your thoughts on this, is because as adults, we are – put into a box. You are now an adult. You have to behave in a certain way. And sometimes that certain way isn't fun, and we lose our zeal. We lose our life engagement. And I think gamification helps us to bring back that zeal that we lost. Your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The research shows that children are learning through play more than they are through lecture. And none of the research actually says that this stops at any given age. But we come to the feeling that we need to be taken seriously, that play looks immature, and so we try and cut that out of our lives, even though
right,
the more we research it, the more we realize we learn more when things are done in a playful way. So it's coming back on the pendulum swing the other way with what you're referring to, gamification. If some of your audiences don't know that word, it means trying to make learning more game-like so that people want to participate in it and choose to. And this is something we know works. It's a question of getting the corporate world to accept it, because the corporate world sometimes wants to take itself very seriously. And what's nice about the improv stuff is that because it's seen as a day off, as something separate from work, people are willing to throw themselves into it. But you're right. In the long run, how do we tie that playfulness back into our workday so that we come up with more creative solutions, so that we are communicating more effectively and doing this on a regular basis, creating excitement for people to come to work, or at the very least, if not excitement, at least a sense of pleasure in being there, so they're not looking to jump ship. Because when your employees jump ship, it costs you a lot to replace them. You lose not just the financial time, but all of the energy that they have taken into learning your company and being a resource is gone. You make people want to be there, that changes a lot. So the gamification
sure
is part of that, but it's also getting the people to enjoy each other. When people are playing the improv games, they end up laughing together. They end up feeling like they succeeded together in something they might not have. You create bonds between people who may not necessarily work together every day. Maybe it's between the admin and an accountant, rather than the accountant and the accountant sitting next to her or him. So you create these vibes within the office where people see each other as fun and likable, and, wow, I'm lucky to have these people around me every day. So one thing we don't get to do very often is choose our coworkers. So since we can't choose them, choosing to find ways to really enjoy them is our second best choice.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so let's talk about this, because you know, in the intro I talked about you working with coaches. Coaching and training people in public speaking is actually what we talked about. So let's
right
talk about this. How does your improv ventures work into teaching me to be a better speaker? Walk me through that. Why is it important to know some of the stuff that you teach?
Okay, that's like three questions in one. So I'll try and cover everything you said in one.
I was improvising. No, go ahead.
I'll start with, how does someone who's doing improv team building end up teaching public speaking skills? Because that doesn't seem like an obvious fit. But there was an in-between step. The in-between step was somebody, groups that were seeing me do the team building, which tends to be smallish groups, 15, 25. I had a whole bunch of them saying, oh, man, you need to do this with big audiences, like a keynote speaker. And at first I didn't see how that would be possible. But I had a number of people saying it to me, and I met someone from the National Speakers Association through improv, just coincidentally, who said, yeah, you should look into the National Speakers Association. So I found my local chapter here in San Diego and started going to the meetings and realized keynoting can be very interactive. It doesn't have to be someone talking for a full hour. Not too many people get as interactive as I do, but I find that audiences really like that. Well, one day I was asked by someone who was doing a showcase for 10 to 12 speakers. I think it was 12 speakers. She said, would you be willing to come and just warm up the crowd with a few improv games before all the other speakers are on so that they are looking, the audience is alive and awake and energized before the camera starts running and we want them to look good in the audience. So I said, sure. And something went wrong at the last minute with the cameraman. Apparently he hadn't been told I was just there to warm up the audience. And he yelled out to the whole audience, remember, everybody, keep your eyes on him the entire 12 minutes he's on the stage. Absolutely no talking in the audience. And you, speaker guy, make sure you get them to laugh. Well, he's basically expecting me to talk for 12 minutes. I had nothing. I was going to lead them in games. I mean, my talking was just going to be explaining to me, like, for 40 seconds how the game worked and then letting them loose. So on the spot, I had to make up a keynote speech for 12 minutes. And I said, well, since I've just lost all the what I was going to do, how about I just tell you some of these strange and interesting and fun things that have happened to me in the world of improv? And that little 12-minute speech led to someone coming up to me and asking to speak at her Rotary Club. And I said, well, okay. And then I made up a 20-minute thing where I did get them to play some games. Little by little, becoming a motivational speaker who gets the whole audience playing these improv games with me became a bigger part of my business than the team building. And I love speaking to audiences. It's so much fun to get big groups playing and to talk about my theme, which is we got to fail to succeed. It's not enough to just go out there and try. You need to be willing to try big enough that you do fail sometimes, not let it get you down, see what you learn from it, and move on. Because in improv, you should never expect to succeed. If you're playing it way too safe if you always know you're going to succeed in improv. So for a few years, I was doing the keynoting and the team building, and then I started getting people coming up to me after my speeches saying, would you work with me on my speaking skills, the way you tell stories and the way you crafted it and your very unusual PowerPoint, because I do things differently with PowerPoint than a lot of people. Would you help me? And at first I said no a few times, and finally when like the sixth or seventh person asked me, I said, wow, the universe is just dumping this in your lap and you are not listening. I mean, how odd is it that many people are asking you? I said, well, let's give it a try. And discovered I think I have a better skill for helping other people find their ability than for even doing it myself. And now it's probably become 60 to 70% of my business is working one-on-one and in small groups and occasionally in training classes as well, helping people to become better speakers, how to craft their stories, the right balance of stories versus data, what they can do to try and use their face and their voice and their bodies more effectively to convey whatever the message is, whether it's a fun message or selling a medical device, whatever it might be, how to make people come out of there going, that totally held my attention. So that's how I made that odd transition. How improv ties into it, which was the other part of your question, is in the ability to react in the moment, when things happen on stage and to be able to handle it, being able to figure out how to find the energy in what you're doing, how to find ways to tie things together that might not be obvious on the surface so that people can go, I can't believe he connected that thought to that thought. That was really good. And that comes from the improv background, and I show people to some degree how they can develop that through our coaching sessions. Did I answer all the parts in there?
I love that. Yeah. You know what? I think you did. I think you did. And I want to back up and talk about this a little bit in the sense that, you know, sometimes we get this universal nudge, all these people saying, can you help me? Can you help me? Can you help me? And as you said, hey, I said no the first couple times until eventually that light went off and said, hey, this might be something that I should pay attention to. And it's funny how as humans, we sometimes put ourselves in a box. I do this. And so, therefore, I'm going to say no to these other opportunities. And luckily, you didn't say no to those other opportunities, and you're able to, you know, you're able to diverse your income, diverse your ability to help others. So I think that's, you know, there's a lesson there, is all I'm saying. And I'm glad that you were sharp enough to take action.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a nudge to myself to have the courage to say to people, I do this. And initially, I was very straightforward with people that, you know, I'm newer to this. This is my background. My rates are probably lower than other people who do this in the area because I'm building a clientele, but these have been the few successes that I've had. And I got some testimonial letters and put them on my website. And little by little, it got to the point where people were like, well, if you're getting those results, let's give it a shot. Now I've helped hundreds of people and written two books on the topic, and I can stand strong and say, yes, I'm a good speaking coach. I don't have to apologize for the fact that I don't have a communications degree. I've had a different set of experiences from theater and from the National Speakers Association and other things that have led to me having a good instinct to help people to find the good speaker in themselves. Sometimes I'm trying to make a terrible speaker into an acceptable one. Sometimes I'm taking a good speaker and making them into a great one. Depends on what they're looking for, but I seem to have found something that works for me. And, yeah, you're right. I'm very glad I listened to those people because it wasn't on my radar that was something I should be doing.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know what? Let's do this real quick. Let's talk about the framework of a speech. Because, you know, there's Toastmasters is a professional club that helps, that's been helping people develop their speaking abilities for nearly, I don't know, like a century or so. But I understand that what you offer is a little bit different. So talk about your framing or your recommended blueprint for a speech.
Sure. I'm not going to say a darn thing bad about Toastmasters because it's wonderful. I think anyone out there
sure.
who has the time and the energy to put into going to their weekly meetings, I got a lot out of it. I was fortunate that I worked in an office where they had two meetings a week in the building on lunch hour. So it was just so easy for me to make Toastmasters a big part of my life back in the late 80s and early 90s. So I have that background as well. But one thing they were teaching back then, and things might have changed, was a very old methodology called the three-step speech outline. And this probably will sound familiar to you because I've heard it. Even people who don't use Toastmasters tend to know this. It's tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you've got to tell them, and at the end, tell them what you told them.
Tell them what you told them.
And right. And there's nothing wrong with that if you don't have any ideas. It's certainly a lot better than nothing to have a framework. But what I noticed was that a lot of the Toastmasters who were going on to competitions and winning with their speeches were breaking that rule. And I asked one of them about it, not accusatorily, just curious. And he said the line that you're probably not expecting, which is, well, you know, once you know the rules, you can start breaking them. And that made sense to me because it was kind of a very stiff format, the old one. But when I became a coach, I thought, I don't want to teach people rules that they're going to outgrow and want to break. I want to be creating guidelines that they can use as beginners and later on in their abilities. So no matter what their ability is, I'm still using what I am now teaching, which is something called the four steps to successful speech structure. And it comes from the fact that the old model is based on writing, right? An introduction, three supporting paragraphs, and then the worst part was always the conclusion because you'd already said it all, so you went back and you kind of repeated yourself somewhat, and the teacher gave you full credit for doing it because that's what she was taught when she was in fourth grade. But it's not interesting. So the four steps look more like this for me. The first step is called the capture. This is where you grab the audience's attention with something interesting and relevant, even if they don't know why it's relevant, odd as that may sound. That doesn't mean it can't be obvious, but it doesn't have to be. I do a speech based on my book. The speech is called Public Speaking Get A's, Not Z's. And for the first few minutes I'm on stage, all I'm doing is telling a story about my grandfather. The first few words out of my mouth are, I had the privilege of knowing my grandpa Harold for 37 of his 94 years, and he was a great guy who made friends everywhere he went. I haven't said anything about public speaking skills. I even go on from there to tell all the craziness that happens in a restaurant with my grandfather and how he embarrasses the family and so on. Half the people in the audience are thinking, what does this have to do with public speaking skills? Great. That means I've grabbed their attention because they're trying to figure it out. The other half the people in the room have forgotten even what I'm there to talk about. They're just caught up in the story trying to find out what Grandpa's going to do. Great, I've got their attention too. Because in both cases, I know I'm leading up to step two, which is called the transition. And this is where you make it abundantly clear why you did that capture. Because at a certain point, I'm going to say, so inadvertently, my grandfather taught me how important it is to make sure your message is understood. And as speakers, nothing is more important than making sure our message reaches our intended audience in a manner that's clear, interesting, moving, and potentially repeatable. So at that point, and that's the only part of my speech I ever memorize, is those two or three lines in my transition. I do recommend memorize your transition, if nothing else. At that point, the whole audience is going, oh, that's what this has to do with public speaking skills. Great. Grandpa did not express himself clearly. He didn't get the results he wants. I want to express myself clearly. I should pay attention to where Milo's going from here. So that's step two, the transition. Step three is the body, and this is the part, you can't get away from the old model on this one. You got to tell them what you're there to tell them. So in that speech, I then go on with 10 sets of do's and don'ts and things to know about public speaking. Lastly, step four, instead of going back and telling them what you already told them, my feeling is, well, if you grabbed their attention, transitioned effectively, and did a really great body, you shouldn't need to go back and recap. They should have gotten it. So use that time for something more important. I call the capper, C-A-P-P-E-R. And the capper is where we end on a high note. So that might be a final story that's a little different than others that you've used. It could be a call to action. I've seen people use a famous quote and talk about how it relates back to their program. So something that's a little bit different than the rest of the program, that's kind of like the cherry on the top of the cake rather than just a recap. So that's the format that I use. And going back to the capture again, there's no reason the story can't be obviously relevant. One of my clients was doing a whole thing on healthcare, and so his capture was to tell a story of one woman who had been kicked over and over again by how wrong what was going wrong with the healthcare system. And then he led up to his transition was, we're here today to look at ways to prevent these kind of errors from happening in our hospital system. So his capture was obviously relevant to what was going on, but it was still much more interesting than starting with data. He talked about one person, and that's something that's relatable. And making our material relatable makes our speeches much more interesting.
Sure. No, I like that. I think those are both awesome examples, because a lot of people can relate to having a grandpa or having, you know, some grandpa-like figure in their life. And then the gentleman or the client you talked about that opens up with a more relevant or more obviously relevant story that has to deal with healthcare. I think they're both great strategies. All right. So let me ask you this. I'm going to put you on the spot, because you've trained people, you've been a speaker for a long time. What are some of the tops do's and don'ts that you see people, that you recommend people, you know, avoid, and things that they should be doing if they're going to be doing public speaking?
Well, one of them, I alluded to it, when people say, if there's one, I get this question a lot from people, not just in interviews, but in general, like, what's one thing you would say people need to do more of? And it's find the right balance of stories and data. We always feel like we've got to get the data across. They have to have the data. But what we don't take into account is people can only absorb so much data. But if we put them in context, people really tend to get the data that we need to share. So figure out what the most important data is, maybe forward them other data, maybe refer to it later, maybe it's not necessary at this point in time, as much as getting the important data to sink in. I have been in so many conferences, and I watch this, where someone is just sharing data, and you watch people get a little uncomfortable in the audience if you're watching it, and then the speaker will say, for example, and you see the audience exhale and their shoulders drop. Because when they hear the phrase, for example, all of a sudden they know, oh, good, he's going to put in this in some kind of context I can relate to, because I can't absorb any more data. So using that phrase, if you're not using the phrase, for example, or implying it, you know, every couple of minutes at least, you're probably missing out on how people put it in context they can relate to. So that's a big one. Another one on a completely different end of the scale is, you wouldn't go for a run without warming up. Why would you do a speech without warming up? You see people, you know, in movies warming up for an opera or something like that, and they're doing vocal exercises. It's the same thing with speaking. There's things we should be doing to warm ourselves up so that by the time we're out in front of our audience, we're in that mode. I had another coach tell me years ago, you're going to warm up. You just have a choice. You can do it before you get there, or you can warm up for the first half of your speech. So which one is the better choice? And I thought that was really brilliant.
I love that. So, okay, so walk me through an example of how you warm up prior to going on stage.
Sure. So I say we should warm up four things. We want to be warming up our faces, our bodies, our voices, and our minds. And for me, the worst possible speech I can get is that breakfast morning, after breakfast speech, or sometimes before breakfast speech, because I'm a night owl. So I'm getting myself up plenty early so that I'm not rushing there, so I'm feeling in the moment. And in that time that I'm getting up plenty early for that, I'm going to do a few things. To warm up my voice, I'm going to do a variety of vocal exercises, some of which it's too much to go into right now, but a good example of one thing you can do is have a list of tongue twisters. You don't have to get them perfect, but at least working on them is going to kind of get your mouth going a little bit, playing with the idea of being articulate in a good way. So that's one thing you can do, amongst other things, to warm up your voice. To warm up your face, I have people do kind of a fake chewing exercise. I say pretend that you've got two pieces of bazooka in your mouth and try and go to the point where those feel soft in your mouth, because they start out like rocks bazooka, and then move that piece of gum all around the back of your face. Of course, it's fake gum, so you can move your tongue in all different positions. And what you'll find is if you do it for a minute or two, your face feels tired. Well, that's because you got to get those muscles moving. If you look like you're dead face because your muscles haven't warmed up, it's hard to look expressive. And especially for the people in the back of the room, the more you're big-faced, the more it's going to help. To warm up your body, I'll always make sure, even if I was clean from the night before, maybe I took a shower before bed, there's another one in the morning. Get muscles have to have a little bit of heat into them. If I have time, I'll even get on my elliptical that I have in my apartment so that I can get myself moving. That way, if I want to turn to the left a gesture and I want to be big with my body, like I'm doing it right now on the phone without even thinking about it, I want to feel like I'm taking up as much space on that stage as I can, so I want to be comfortable with my body. And lastly, warming up your mind. If I have time, I'll do a crossword puzzle or the bridge column in the newspaper or answer some emails, anything to make my mind active, because I could pull myself together at 7 o'clock, throw some clothes on, drive over there, and if the first time I'm engaging my mind is saying hello to the people in the audience, I'm not going to be feeling sharp if something goes awry. If something I have to adapt on the moment, I want to feel sharp. So I want to warm up my mind as well. So our bodies, our voices, our faces, and our minds are all things we should be spending a little time warming up on before we ever get going. Of course, if you're around the office, you got to find a private conference room to do some of those things in so you don't look crazy at your office. But that's what the drive is for. I do half of these things on the drive over there because I feel like I got the privacy to warm up that way.
Yeah, I love that. I like that so very, very much. Now, let me ask you this, because – as I mentioned earlier, you know, one of the challenges with starting a speaking career is that it takes very little effort, very little cost, right, to become a speaker or an actor or whatever. So when it comes to marketing your speaking career or your speaking services, did you start off by giving free speeches and then developing some leads from there? How did you start marketing yourself? What do you suggest people market their speaking services?
I think you're right. Yes, I did start out by giving it away for free, which involved contacting Rotary Clubs, Lions Clubs, Kiwanis Clubs, Sir Optimus Clubs, groups like that, looking for places where you could hone the craft and hone the speech. Because if you find, people really react to this part, wow, this part kind of lay dead. Let them know that part of the reason you're willing to do it for free is in return for feedback on what worked and what didn't work. It's going to take time to work out what it is you want to cover in your area of passion. If you don't know, of course, you have to have an area of passion. The idea that I just want to be a speaker doesn't work. I really wanted to find ways to show people how the improv and taking chances in your life was going to work, and talking about places in my life and in people's history where taking chances made a difference. So having those different ways of getting out and finding audiences really helped. After a while, the combination of the word spreading on that and people hitting my website, because the website is a huge thing too, optimizing your website so that people who are searching for a motivational speaker, a keynote speaker in your area, especially if you add your topic of speech, all of a sudden, every once in a while, the phone rings. And if they're reaching out to you, you're in a better position to tell them your fee. What your fee should be is one of the hardest things to figure out in the world. I can promise you it's a lot more than it was when I started.
Sure.
But you kind of just have to choose a number that you feel you can say to people without them feeling you cringe through the phone. And then at the point where you notice that a few people in a row are saying yes, then you raise it and you cringe and you hope. And little by little you discover what will and won't work. You know, I've gone through some testing the waters on raising my prices, went a little too high, backed up, discovered I didn't have to back up all the way. It's a trick to playing that game over time. And as you get better, you'll warrant the price that you might have cringed at saying after a while, because you'll be better and you'll be accomplishing something. especially when the word starts to spread and someone says, hey, I heard you speak at the such and such conference. I wonder if you'd be willing to come to our company and do it. And conferences are another place. Some conferences pay, some conferences don't. It depends on who it is. But if it's a strong target audience for you, that might be something where you say, you know what, it's worth passing up on my fee because there's 100 people in this room who are good target audiences for me. For instance, for me, I absolutely would speak free to an HR audience because those are all people who could say, oh, my gosh, our CEO really needs to work with this guy. And so if I'm going to make the money on the back end, maybe seven times over because seven people in that audience contact me out of 100, then that's worth doing the speech for free. So you figure out what's what.
Right, right. And I want to just emphasize what you just said there. Giving a free speech because it's your right audience, that is, to me, one of the best ways to leverage that because it is your ideal audience. It's the kind of people that you would pay, you know, good money to get in front of, you know, with marketing or advertising. Now you can get in front of them for free. You want to go in there, guns a-blazing, go all out and just wow everybody because this is your opportunity to, as you said, walk away with 7 or 8 or 10 leads. And you'll probably close half of them, depending on your system and your rates and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's what that's all about.
I know a lot of people get hung up on free stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's selective. At this point, I'm not taking a free speech from the Kiwanis, most likely because of the fact that it's mostly retirees in there. They're not in a position, many of them, to hire me. And, of course, you've got to say, well, there's always a possibility. Well, the flip side in life is you got to figure out where your priorities are, and chances are that's probably not a good use of my time unless I'm working on a new speech. Then I'm not going to try that out on a paid audience. I'm going to contact the Kiwanis Club and say, hey, I normally charge X amount for a program, but I'm working on a new one. Might you all be interested in hearing it and giving me some feedback and seeing how it goes? And that might be a perfect place to try out a new speech for me. But as far as the target audiences, yes, the trick is not to look like you're selling. You've got to go in there ready to give them a presentation where they will never walk out going, I can't believe I spent, you know, that much time in there and all I felt like it was a commercial for his company. That said, even if they say we don't allow any selling from the platform, and I will respect that, there are ways to have them leave knowing that you're available. You can say, okay, no selling. Could I give each person a handout, though, as long as I didn't take any time? Maybe they'll allow you to give out a handout, so then they learn from you that way. Or I might say something like, you know, last week I was working with one of my coaching clients, and we found that when she did this with her voice, the audience responded to it. So I've done two things there. I have talked about the use of the voice, which is educational and helping them. But did you catch what I also did at the beginning of the sentence? I said
sure,
I was working with one of my speaking clients. Right. So now, without talking about my coaching practice and how I can accomplish things and why coaching is helpful, I've planted the seed that, oh, he's available as a coach. So I've never had an audience balk at something like that. It's within the context of teaching them that I let them know that. So there's subtle ways to do it. And I've watched people not do it subtly and really tick off the audience. So it's something, again, over time you learn how you can find little ways to do that without feeling like you're mentioning your and with my website and my e-zine and come sign up. And, of course, I want them to do the thing. That's on the form. I always ask for a feedback form, and I have a box on there. Would you be interested in my free e-zine with tips on how to improve your speaking and other business things? And I tie in improv stuff with it. And, you know, a certain percentage of the audience, if they enjoy me, will say yes, and then I add them on. So be it. But it wasn't salesy that way.
I love it. I love it. There's so much there to learn. The book is called Prepared, Polished, and Powerful.
No, no, it's not.
The author.
That's just the tagline at the bottom.
I'm sorry. So, what is the name of the book?
I don't want to totally interrupt, but I couldn't have you leave people thinking that was the title. The title is Public Speaking.
Let's not promote the wrong thing here, right? Oh, there it is. Get A's, not Z's, as in putting people to sleep. Get A's, not C. And you can find it at Improv Ventures, or I'm assuming it's available on Amazon as well.
You can get it on Amazon because people miss the 7 Z's and Z. It might be easiest just to go to my side website, which is publicdynamics.com. That's all about me as a public speaking coach, or improvventures.com, which is about the improv team building stuff we talked about at the beginning. You'll find access to the links to the books there instead of trying to hunt them down on Amazon.
I love it. Milo, it's been a blast having you on the show. I'd love to bring you back and talk more about marketing and speaking.
That'd be a pleasure.
And improv, Milo Shapiro. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Take care.
Good stuff there from Milo. Absolutely. Good stuff there from Milo Shapiro. And I love the idea of you know, adding improv to your speechifying. Because improv is something, is a muscle that sometimes we simply do not use. We're afraid to use it, which is silly. But it happens, right? It's what happens to us as adults. You know, when we're kids, we tend to improv very well. We don't care about how we look. But as we get older, all that stuff becomes seriously important. Anyway, look, bottom line is, check out Milo Shapiro and his team, and just remember that no matter what, right, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch, and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.